This is broadcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off for Labor Day, but please enjoy our recent interview with LA Times Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Michael Hiltzik on the truth behind California's new minimum wage law for fast food workers and Brad's recent conversation with national security journalist Marcy Wheeler of EmptyWheel.net.
And, you know, business owners are fed up. And, you know, quite frankly, people can't afford fast food. $20 an hour minimum wage is only going to equal a $20 an hour, a $20 Big Mac for everybody.
Are you sure about that? Are you sure about that, California business lobbyist Tom Manzo? Or are you just making it up for Fox News?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
He's making it up.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
But Fox is glad to hear it.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
We'll discuss.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast. That's heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me. Oh, and California fast food eater, says me. From bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Many of us woke progressive liberal leftists were celebrating last year when, at long last, California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom signed a measure in September that would raise the minimum wage for fast food workers here in the Golden State at nationally owned chain restaurants that have 60 or more stores from $16 an hour to $20 an hour. It would be good for hundreds of thousands of workers in the sector, good for the entire economy in California, given that so many workers would now have more money in their pockets to spend into the economy, floating all boats. Win-win all around, right? The bill was signed in September of last year, with wages set to go up for workers on April 1 of this year. But before that could even happen, according to the Wall Street Journal, the law was already a disaster, not just for owners of major fast food outlets across the state, but for thousands of workers who had already been laid off by those companies. Thanks to the new law, they simply couldn't afford those workers anymore at $20 an hour. As the Rupert Murdoch-owned Journal reported in late March this year, just days before California state law would actually take effect, California restaurants cut jobs as fast food wages set to rise. They note that some restaurants are already laying off staff and reducing hours for workers as they try to cut costs. California restaurants, they say, particularly pizza joints, have outlined plans to cut hundreds of jobs in the months leading up to the April 1 wage mandate, according to state records. Other operators said that they have halted hiring altogether or are scaling back workers' hours. Well, that sounds bad. A few months later, just a couple weeks ago in early June, after the law actually went into effect back in April, the Rupert Murdoch-owned New York Post followed up on the California fast food apocalypse to report how bad it has actually become. California fast food restaurants have slashed nearly 10,000 jobs because of the state's new $20 minimum wage, they say, as struggling franchises, including McDonald's and Burger King, according to the Post, cut labor costs and raise prices to survive. The California Business and Industrial Alliance, or CABIA, described by the Post as a major trade group, slammed Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom for pushing through the law, which went into effect April 1, and was blamed for forcing one beloved taco chain to shutter 48 locations in the state. According to the New York Post, CABIA president and founder Tom Manzo told Rupert Murdoch-owned Fox Business, quote, "California businesses have been under total attack and total assault for years." Well, I guess that's why there are so few fast food joints out here in California. A kid, of course, there is no shortage of them. Nonetheless, Manzo warned, quote, "It's just another law that puts business in further jeopardy." Manzo said nearly 10,000 jobs have been cut across the fast food restaurants since Newsom signed California Assembly Bill 1287 into law last year, adding that officials were living in a, quote, "fantasy land" by thinking that drastic wage increases will help workers or businesses. Cabia then took out a full-page ad in USA Today. Not the LA Times, mind you, or some other California paper, but the national USA Today that includes a mock obituary of popular fast food brands. In memoriam, the ad notes in huge letters at the top of the page, victims of Newsom's minimum wage. It goes on to say in all caps, California loses nearly 10,000 fast food jobs after $20 minimum wage signed last fall, before explaining that between last fall, when Newsom signed the measure, and this past January, quote, "California fast food restaurants cut about 9,500 jobs, representing a 1.3% change from September of 2023. They cited data, they said, was provided by the Hoover Institution in late April. Above photos of dozens of restaurant chain stores, from McDonald's to Burger King to El Pollo Loco to Subway to Pizza Hut to Cinnabon and more, all closed, I guess. They said they were being devastated by Newsom's mandate and being forced to both raise prices and fire workers. Way at the bottom of the full page ad in USA Today, we are told that it is from Cabia.org and that the ad was paid for by the California Business and Industrial Alliance. The New York Post cites what it described as a recent survey conducted by LendingTree, finding that 78% of consumers now consider fast food to be a, quote, "luxury purchase" due to how expensive the meals have become. Part of the push for the hike, according to the paper, was to give fast food workers more financial freedom in a state known for its high cost of living. However, critics contend fast food jobs were meant for young people as a stepping stone. Quoting Manzo again from Cabia, the California Business and Industrial Alliance, quote, "It's a starter industry," Manzo said. "You get a job as a kid working in a fast food restaurant and you learn some good work ethic and that takes you into life," which, of course, ignores the thousands of workers in their 30s and 40s and 50s and older who have been working at such restaurants for decades. But still, if those workers are all going to be laid off, with 10,000 of them already laid off even before the law took effect this April, well, I guess this law is a bad one. And not only bad for California, apparently, but I guess given all the coverage in national outlets outside of California, it must be bad for workers elsewhere as well, just in case any of those pesky workers may get the idea in states other than liberal, woke California that they might also enjoy a living wage someday. Meanwhile, in an actual California newspaper, the Los Angeles Times last week, Pulitzer Prize-winning business reporter Michael Hiltzik reports, "The fast food industry has been wringing its hands over the devastating impact on its businesses from California's new minimum wage law for its workers. Their raw figures certainly seem to bear that out. A full-page ad recently placed in USA Today by the California Business and Industrial Alliance asserted that nearly 10,000 fast food jobs had been lost in the state since Governor Gavin Newsom signed the law in September. But here's something you might want to know about this claim," writes Hiltzik. "It's baloney. Sliced thick. In fact," he notes, "from September through January, the period covered by the ad, fast food employment in California has actually gone up, as tracked by no less than the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Federal Reserve. The claim that it has fallen represents a flagrant misrepresentation of government employment figures," writes Hiltzik. What? A misrepresentation of facts by Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal and Rupert Murdoch's New York Post and Rupert Murdoch's Fox Business Channel and by the California Business and Industrial Alliance? Say It Ain't So. Here to say it is so, I suspect, is Michael Hiltzik, longtime Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and business columnist for the LA Times, where he has served as a financial and political writer, an investigative reporter, a technology writer, an editor, a foreign correspondent, and he is the author of several books, including what I believe is his latest, Iron Empires, Robber Barons, Railroads, and the Making of Modern America. Mr. Hiltzik, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to be back with you.
So, you know, there's the old saying, Michael, lies, damn lies, and statistics. You report that not only during the period covered by Kabia's full-page ad in USA Today in June, curiously, covering the period from September of last year until January of this year, that fast food employment in California actually went up. And in April of this year, after the new minimum wage actually went into effect, fast food establishment employment was actually higher by nearly 7,000 jobs than it was in April of 2023. So how can employment both be down, according to Kabia, and yet up, according to you and those slackers at the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics?
Right. Well, what we're dealing with here is the misuse of employment figures by essentially using non-seasonally adjusted figures rather than what we should be using, or what Kabia and the Wall Street Journal should be using, which is seasonally adjusted. And I think a lot of your listeners have heard the term seasonally adjusted employment, and what that basically means is that when you have an industry in which employment fluctuates during the year for seasonal reasons, you have to use seasonally adjusted figures, and that's because it's inaccurate to say employment rose or fell during some period of the year when what you are seeing is something is a phenomenon that happens year after year. And that's the case with fast food restaurants and indeed almost all restaurants. It's well understood. Everybody in the restaurant business knows this, that business is best for restaurants in sort of the March to September period. This is a time when you've got Mother's Day and Father's Day in the beginning of summer, when people are going out to eat or getting their families together to go out to eat. And then and employment in restaurants peaks in September year after year after year, and then falls in January year after year after year because the holidays are over, people are tapped out. You know, the weather breaks and they're not so inclined to go out of doors to eat anymore. And we know this. And in fact, in California, what happened between September 2023 and January 2024, which is the period that Kabia purports to say was affected by the signing of this law, in fact, employment unseasonally adjusted fell by about 9,500 jobs in the fast food sector. But that's what happens as summer turns to fall and we begin to see the beginning of winter year after year after year. So what you have to do when you have figures like this is compare it not one month to the next month or a few months later. You have to compare each month to the same month in other years. And that's why the Bureau of Labor Statistics says that, in fact, employment in the sector in California went up in late 2023 compared to 2022 and went up again in early 2024 compared to the same early period in 2023. And everybody knows, any economist knows that when you're dealing with these sorts of industries, you absolutely must use seasonally adjusted figures. The Wall Street Journal didn't seem to know this, even though they're supposed to be experts in finance and the economy. They didn't know it. And then those who followed their lead, including Lee Ohanian, who's a UCLA economist who writes for the Hoover Institution, the conservative Hoover Institution, he didn't realize when he cited Wall Street Journal's figures, he didn't realize that they were not using seasonally adjusted figures. And he's a little embarrassed about it because I asked him about it. And he said, gee, I assumed they were seasonally adjusted. But if they're not, I'm going to call and ask them about it. And then I'll write another column for Hoover explaining the error.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, if he's embarrassed about it, I checked just before airtime. It does not look like his article at the Hoover Institution has actually been changed, corrected, or frankly, retracted at this point. And yet this allowed Kabbia to put this ad in the USA Today, citing their numbers as coming from the Hoover Institution, this, you know, well-regarded think tank, rather than the numbers coming from the Wall Street Journal, owned by Rupert Murdoch, and apparently who did not bother to actually check these numbers. So just to underscore what you said, Michael, we always expect jobs in this industry, in the restaurant industry, to go down in the fall between September and the end of the year, January and so forth. So rather than saying, oh, the industry just lost a bunch of jobs, what we need to do is compare it year over year. So in April, when this law goes into effect this year, April 24, the best comparison is to April of 23 as far as jobs. And what you're saying is there's almost 10,000 more jobs in the fast food industry after the $20 wage has gone into effect this year than there was last year when it was only 16. Do I understand that correct?
Yeah, actually, there were 7,000 more jobs in what the BLS, or the Bureau of Labor Statistics, calls the limited service restaurant sector mm-hmm. in California. 7,000 more jobs this past April after the minimum wage law went into effect over the previous year, which was April 2023, was months before Newsom signed the minimum wage bill. In fact, mm-hmm. it was a little uncertain whether he would sign it, but he ultimately did. So that's the comparison you really need to use,
right?
Not sort of fabricated false comparison of September of 2023 to January of 2024. So look, maybe the Wall Street Journal reporter made a mistake. Maybe she did or didn't, but certainly Kabbia knows the truth of seasonal variations
yes.
in restaurant employment because that's the business they're in. So, I think maybe the Wall Street Journal made a mistake, but it sure looks as if Kabbia lied.
And it looks like let me just support one of their claims here a bit. Kabbia says, and then the New York Post and Fox Business all dutifully report, quote, that Rubio's California Grill, known for its fish tacos, closed 48 of its nearly 134 locations at the end of May. The first major chain to fall victim to the new law, they say. Well, that sounds bad, Michael. They had to close about a third of their locations because of Gavin Newsom's law. And who doesn't love Rubio's California fish tacos? your response to that?
Yeah, well, that's a completely fabricated notion. And in fact, it's contradicted by the actual numbers out of Rubio. I mean, Rubio had to declare bankruptcy a few weeks ago, and it had a final declaration as to what its finances were like. And what we find there is not that they were brought down all of a sudden by the need to pay their frontline workers $20 an hour. They were brought down by the fact that they came under the control of a private equity firm that did what private equity does for a living, which is that it saddled the company with a tremendous amount of debt so that the private equity firm could sort of cash out, mm-hmm. you know, the money that it to buy Rubio's. You know, in 2020, when this private equity firm acquired Rubio's, Rubio's had no debt. No debt. Well, today, or at the time that it finally filed for bankruptcy, it had $72 million of debt.
So
what do you think is actually causing Rubio to be in financial trouble.
So it wasn't Gavin Newsom's law. It was private equity that did in Rubio's. And yet that is cited in all of these articles. Oh, they're closing 48 stores across California thanks to Gavin Newsom. Now, all of this, it seems to me, Michael Hiltzik, you know, has done its job. Just looking at the comments over at hoover.org, where this article has not been retracted. Matthew Lim says, democracy eats itself. Everyone, tell your California friends about this and stop voting for authoritarian tyrants like Newsom. Another guy says, named Art, I had my first burger and fries, no drink, just a burger and fries last night. I fell over with the $19 price. That's it for me. I'm 84 years old, live on a fixed income. Going out for a burger and fries once in a while has been a treat for me. Fine dining, no more. Thank you, Governor.
Yeah, well, all I can say is I doubt it. I mean, one burger and fries at a fast food restaurant doesn't cost $19. We know that. I mean, we've all, you know, we've all been at the, you know, the drive-up windows of, you know, it's, you know, unless you're, you know, you're not telling, you know, the whole story, it's not really a credible.
So, Michael, you know, we're a national show. We do not solely focus on California, even though this story would seem to be a California-centric story. But I note that all of these articles, with all of their completely misleading numbers and information about all of these job losses since raising the minimum wage for workers in California, they come from outlets like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Post and Fox Business, and an ad taken out not in the LA Times, but in USA Today. Am I being too conspiratorial here by noticing that this story has been nationalized by these companies for some reason to sort of send a warning perhaps to other states where low wage workers might be, you know, thinking about trying to improve their working conditions? Am I leaning too far over my skis with that?
No, I think basically, you know, once again, this is what industry lobbyists do for a living. Yeah, they are trying to scare politicians in other states away from raising the minimum wage. And look, you know, the minimum wage in this state and across the country has barely budged until very recently from where it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago. I'm sure, you know, PR executives have gotten nice raises in all that time. So, yeah, basically they're fabricating facts and statistics to basically get their own way and, you know, keep doing what they're doing and protect their own profits. They don't care about the workers. You know, they'd be happy if the workers were making half as much. So, yeah, this is what's going on.
And I'm pretty sure a bunch of those companies have CEOs who have seen their salaries go way up in recent years. But the other reason I'm glad that you cover this, Michael, and that we're able to expand on it a bit here nationally is because this feels like to me one of those zombie lies that kind of exists forever if it is not rebutted and rebutted loudly and early. You know, anytime, for example, fast food workers in other states, you know, might get the idea that they too should be paid a living wage. Well, all we have to do now is cite the thousands of workers who were laid off when California did it, and it devastated the fast food industry across the state, you know, with few at that point likely to do the digging that you did to disprove this entire you know, rotten tube of thickly sliced bologna, I guess.
Yeah, you know, there's, you know, another element to this, which is that there's sort of an assumption out there that raising the minimum wage costs jobs. And what you hear, you know, certainly, you know, some of the pushback that I got from my column was everybody knows that you raise the minimum wage, you know, people get laid off. Well, you know, it makes sense, doesn't it? And the answer to that is that there's no evidence for that. That studies, you know, over and over and over in all parts of the United States have shown that when the minimum wage is raised, there's virtually no employment effect. may be very small, but in most cases, there's no employment effect. People don't lose their jobs. And in fact, everybody is better off because the minimum wage workers get more money, and that pushes wages up across the entire spectrum. So this is a good thing. And, you know, and as I've said, you know, we haven't raised the federal minimum wage, which is $7.25 an hour.
Yeah.
In, you know, 15 years or more. So, you know, franchise owners, fast food operators, they've all been sort of living in a dream world that they can basically push wages down as far as they can, despite everything. And it's really got to end.
And there's one more element to this I want to note before I let you go, Michael. You know, Fox News and its print media partners like the Wall Street Journal, New York Post, not to mention the California GOP, whose email list I have found myself on for some reason, and they are just inveterate liars. It's amazing. But they all really seem to have it out for Gavin Newsom. And they've been willing to, you know, to go all in with some extraordinary lies about him and that, you know, blame him for everything. Of course, this apocalypse of fast food in California. All of this suggests to me that they are really, really frightened of him on a national level, as he'll almost certainly be running for president, I suspect, in the not too distant future. Would you agree with that assessment that a lot of these attacks also are, well, very convenient and helpful ways to try to attack Gavin Newsom?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things at play here. First of all, yeah, sure. You know, Newsom sort of represents in the conservative right-wing mind the quintessential progressive political leader. Mm-hmm. But he also is, after all, the governor of California, and they love to bash California. Because, you know, they project an image of California as very, very liberal. And, it, you know, so it's been sort of a, you know, a target for the right wing for a few decades now.
Mm-hmm.
So here's Newsom, who's, you know, sort of well-groomed and well put together and expresses an extremely progressive worldview on climate change and global warming and things like that. So, yeah, he's naturally going to be a target. I think to his credit, he handles all that pretty well. You know, he doesn't shy away from his principles just because he's getting attacked by the likes of the Wall Street Journal.
Michael Hiltzik, I know that fact-checking these right-wing liars these days is more than a full-time job, so I'm very grateful that you took the time to rebut at least this one piece of nonsense that, like I said, you know, will likely become a zombie lie for years nonetheless, no matter what we do. But thank you for doing what you do and for joining us on the broadcast to explain it today. Michael Hiltzik is the Pulitzer Prize-winning business columnist at the L.A. Times. You can find his work there, latimes.com. You can find him on Twitter at HiltzikM. And you can find more about him and buy all of his books, by the way, at michaelhiltzik.com. Michael, great speaking with you, my friend. Look forward to the next time.
Okay, anytime.
Thank you. All right, let's take a quick break. We will come back with our friend Marcy Wheeler of Empty Wheel to help make some sense of what is and isn't known to have happened in this recently reported hack of the Trump campaign, said to be by Iranian affiliates, if there was a hack, if they were Iranian, and some of the potential very disturbing problems that are not yet being reported, if in fact all of that actually happened. We'll get it all sorted out and make sense of it somehow after this. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast.
This is Jackson Brown, and you're listening to KPFK, the inspiration station. Lifeline to the community, lifeline to the news and the information, to the culture that sees us through the year, year after year. I'm asking you to take a moment and make contribution to the station that keeps your world alive and in tune. The number to call is 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK. KPFK has been there my whole life. I don't really know how I would view the world without it.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
And the spies came out of the water. She's feeling so bad, 'cause you know. And the spies hide out in every corner.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As multiple media sources have been reporting since the weekend, at least three news outlets were leaked confidential material said to have come from inside the Donald Trump campaign in recent days, including its report vetting J.D. Vance as a vice presidential candidate. So far, each outlet, first Politico, then New York Times, then Washington Post, has refused to reveal any noteworthy details about what they received exactly. Instead, all three have written about what they have described as a potential hack of the Trump campaign and described the material given to them in broad terms. Politico wrote over the weekend about receiving emails starting July 22 from someone identifying themselves only as Robert that included a 271-page campaign document about Vance and a partial vetting report on Senator Marco Rubio, who is also considered as a potential vice president for Donald Trump. Both Politico and the Post said that two people had independently confirmed that the documents were authentic. The Times wrote about the Vance report, quote, like many such vetting documents, they contained past statements with the potential to be embarrassing or damaging, such as Mr. Vance's remarks casting aspersions on Mr. Trump. But the decisions by the three outlets to not publish the material, observes AP's David Bowder, stands in marked contrast to the 2016 presidential campaign, when a Russian hack exposed emails to and from Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, John Podesta, at the time. The website WikiLeaks published a trove of these embarrassing, if not particularly newsworthy, missives, and mainstream news organizations covered them avidly. On the heels of the reported leaks from the Trump campaign, the campaign claimed that it had been hacked by Iran. While the campaign provided no evidence for that claim, it came just a day or so after a Microsoft report had detailed an effort by an Iranian military intelligence unit to compromise the email account of a former senior advisor to a presidential campaign, though the report did not specify which campaign. That was enough, apparently, for the Trump campaign to declare that they had been hacked and that the culprit was Iran. The Trump campaign over the weekend appeared to threaten any media outlets who might even consider publishing internal Trump campaign documents. This so-called Robert had told the news outlets that they had access to much more. Campaign spokesperson Steve Chung, however, said, quote, any media or news outlet reprinting documents or internal communications are doing the bidding of America's enemies, unquote. But of course, the Trump campaign back in 2016 had a very different feeling about publishing internal communications from the Democratic Hillary Clinton campaign that was seemingly hacked by another of America's enemies. In fact, Donald Trump himself led the way.
Now, this just came out. WikiLeaks. I love WikiLeaks. The Hillary Clinton documents released today by WikiLeaks. Exposed by WikiLeaks.
We don't talk about WikiLeaks.
They want to distract us from WikiLeaks.
WikiLeaks.
WikiLeaks. The WikiLeaks revelations. They got it all down, folks. WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks. Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
So that was back in 2016. Now, contrast that to today, 2024, when the Trump campaign says that any media or news outlet reprinting documents or internal communications from the Trump campaign are doing the bidding of America's enemies. In 2020, you'll recall, the Trump campaign was similarly interested in encouraging media outlets to report on material said to have been purloined from a laptop computer owned by Joe Biden's son, Hunter. Now, however, the Team Trump is adamant that outlets who publish such material are doing the bidding of America's enemies. The FBI released a brief statement on Monday that read, quote, "We can confirm the FBI is investigating this matter." By Tuesday, CNN and others reported that investigators probing the apparent hack and leak operation suspect the hackers were able to compromise the personal email accounts of Republican dirty trickster, convicted felon, longtime Trump buddy, Roger Stone. The hackers reportedly used access to Stone's compromised email accounts to try and then break into the account of a senior Trump campaign official as part of a persistent effort to access campaign networks. All of that said, I don't know that it is even confirmed yet that the leaks in question, which Trump's campaign manager blames on Iran, actually came from Iran, or even were even a hack at all, for that matter, as opposed to a leak, as the person named Robert suggested. But if they were a hack by Iran, reports our friend Marcy Wheeler, it could be much, much worse than access gained simply to, those campaign vetting documents. In fact, given the way that the Trump campaign and Trump legal team appear to intermingle files, notes Wheeler, this intrusion by whoever it was could actually be more than just a threat to Trump, but could threaten U.S. national security itself. Here to explain all of that, what we know and what we don't know, is the great independent national security journalist Marcy Wheeler of EmptyWheel.net, who, in addition to blogging every day at her own site, has also been a contributor over the years to publications like The Intercept, The New York Times, The Guardian, Politico, and others. Oh, Marcy, thank you for staying up after hours out there in Ireland to join us again here on the broadcast.
Always good to talk to people in California.
It's good to be in California. Come on out and visit. Anyway, Ms. Marcy. So first, I'd like to very simply clarify some things that we know and some things that we don't know before getting deeper into some of the more disturbing questions and observations that you raised about national security and so forth. So first, just a few easy, hopefully simple clarifying questions that have been hard to come by clear answers for in the mainstream reporting. Team Trump has said they were hacked by Iran, but for some reason, I don't exactly trust Team Trump for anything. So do we, A, know for a fact that the campaign was actually hacked at all versus, you know, either an attempt to hack or a leak from an insider versus a hack? And well, before I get to B, let me let you answer A.
So Washington Post, on a story that included Ellen Nakashima and Shane Harris, so people who are good on hacking, said that they had confirmed this Microsoft report about a former advisor, his account being hacked, and Iranian Republican guards basically using that compromised account to try and hack, to try and compromise the account of an existing top Trump advisor. So they said that. And then Chris Krebs, who was the head of CISA, so the head of this kind of stuff under Trump until Trump fired him for telling the truth.
The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Yes, go ahead.
Right. Whose job it is to keep election secure, said, this is the real thing. From what I hear, it's the real thing. So those are three people who are reliable, who all say the description that Microsoft gave, which is that a former advisor was hacked and that Iranian Republican Guard hackers used that account to try and hack a Trump official, that refers to Donald Trump's campaign. Mm-hmm. So, and frankly, in the stories on the FBI investigating it, they also revealed that three people in the Biden-Harris orbit, you know, because mm-hmm. this is in the period when they were transitioning, mm-hmm. were also, there were attempted fishes of them that were, the implication is unsuccessful. So this is not a campaign targeting just Donald Trump. They also targeted Biden-Harris. And thus far, the only thing that we can be certain of is that somebody, some former advisor of Donald Trump, was actually hacked. And Roger Stone and his attorney have said that that was him.
So it seems like we've got these various sort of disparate pieces that everyone is suggesting links up, but that we don't yet have the hard material to know that, yes, Iran was responsible for trying to hack, then succeeding to hack, then getting these documents, and then sharing them with these media outlets. But all of these pieces seem to suggest as much, even if it's actually hard confirmed, right?
Second?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that's important is the stories from reliable journalists who said that the FBI says they're investigating mm-hmm. is they'll say that, sure, Roger Stone was hacked. Sure, three people were targeted on the Biden-Harris orbit and that there was an attempt to hack a Trump advisor. What they won't say, what those stories are pretty clear about, is that the FBI is not yet confirming that the documents shared with Politico, New York Times, and Washington Post, that mm-hmm. those came from the hack. And it raises interesting questions. Maybe only Roger Stone was hacked. Maybe he had J.D. Vance's vetting file. Maybe Roger Stone has files on Donald Trump's criminal or Donald Trump's legal cases, which the persona says also happened. So one explanation for this is that Donald Trump was never hacked. Roger Stone was, and he's got a lot more files than maybe he should.
Now, you have a better memory than me, Marcy Wheeler, but I believe I'm recalling back in 2016 when Trump actually criticized the Democrats for being hacked as having, you know, weak security on their computer networks, claiming that Russians or whoever had also tried to hack the GOP, but that their defenses were far superior to the inept Democrats. Am I remembering that correctly?
Oh, you know, the amount of schadenfreude that people should absolutely engage in only starts there. I mean, my favorite one is that for 7 years, Republicans have said, if you are hacked, you must immediately provide your server to the FBI. And if you don't, it will not be investigated properly. And so, I mean, of course, none of the goldfish journalists swimming around Donald Trump will ask him this, but you know, according to the rules the Republicans have set down for 7 years, Donald Trump should stop mid-campaign, mid whatever crimes he's in the process of committing because he can't help himself, and hand his servers over to the FBI to properly investigate this alleged attack by Iran. That is what should happen. And that's where I want to go, because I want to see that happen.
Because their criticism back in 2016 and for years thereafter from Republicans, from Fox News, was they were furious that the FBI never demanded the DNC turn over all of their computers, but instead they made, I guess, copies of the hard drive, images of it, these, you know, sort of byte by byte copies of the hard drives for their investigation. And then, yeah, they spent years saying it wasn't a real investigation because they didn't turn over the computers. So no evidence that the Trump campaign is turning over all of their computer servers to the FBI.
No, but then again, I mean, with the people pretending to be journalists swimming around Donald Trump, he's not going to be asked that. He's going to be asked for the 15th time, you know, let's talk about crowd sizes and inviting him to lie about crowd sizes.
I noted in my intro that the mainstream media outlets, in a seemingly very different posture from what we saw in previous years, particularly in 2016, speaking of those goldfish media, they were not publishing the material that they got from this leaker, whoever it was. Why do you think that is? And by the way, should they be running at least whatever might be newsworthy and vetted and authenticated and so forth from this material?
There is a newsworthy story they're not telling, and that is to look through the dossier they have on J.D. Vance and figure out where the holes are. And the reason that's newsworthy is because, among other outlets, the New York Times, which of course has this dossier, has quoted Donald Trump himself asking whether the people who vetted J.D. Vance knew of some of the things that have come out.
Mm-hmm.
So the Trump campaign is surprised by stuff they should have picked up in vetting, like the cat ladies, the single cat ladies.
Childless cat ladies, yes.
Childless cat ladies. Like, he did not know about the childless cat ladies. I want to know whether they knew about the picture of him in drag while he was at Yale. And so it is newsworthy and very easy to look at the vetting document. It's only 300 pages. I could do it and say, oh gosh, they did actually miss the childless cat ladies. They did miss the drag. They did miss the foreword for a Nazi. They did miss the other foreword for a Nazi. They did miss the third foreword for somebody who, you know, wrote the Project 2025 mm-hmm. that we're claiming to have nothing. I mean, those are real questions, and you don't have to publish the dossier itself. You don't have to infringe on J.D. Vance's privacy, as if he cares about ours. So, you don't have to infringe on his privacy to do that story.
So,
and it is
a
real story. Trump has made it a story. Donald Trump's donors have made it a story.
And if you receive this, Marcy Wheeler, if this Robert persona actually contacted you, actually gave you those documents, you would run them, at least if not publishing the full document, but publish those newsworthy facts if Robert were to contact you?
If Robert were to contact me, I would run what I just said.
Even
would,
if they're potentially stolen documents?
Yeah, I think I would, because it is newsworthy and because it goes to... In the months ahead, we're going to have another interesting conversation about whether Donald Trump plans to, instead of Ivanka and Jared Kushner, who were unqualified but at least mediocre, whether he plans to put his other spawn, Don Jr. especially, who is unqualified and also an idiot, in the White House. And Don Jr. is the one who largely pushed the choice of J.D. Vance on Donald Trump.
Uh-huh.
And so this goes to the qualification of Trump and his family. And given the last administration, we have good cause to say we need to vet your family too, because we don't know if you're going to give them security clearance and plop them in the middle of the Oval Office.
Now, as you report at Empty Wheel this week, there are two even more troubling points about all of this that sort of gained your attention. One, that an email breach had actually occurred earlier this summer, and according to the reporting, and that the Trump campaign did not inform the FBI about it, never mind giving them the servers, but they didn't even tell the FBI about it. And two, the documents promised by this Robert character are said to be marked as, quote, privileged and confidential, and could include both internal Trump campaign emails and documents related to Trump's court cases. So, can you explain those two concerns and why each of those seems to have really raised your own alarm bells above and beyond how this has otherwise been reported by the corporate media to date?
Well, it sounds like what we've learned since then, that the FBI and Microsoft figured out they'd been hacked and then approached them, as the FBI tried to do with Hillary Clinton in 2016, and she just sort of blew it off for months.
They figured Microsoft and the FBI figured out that Iran had hacked the Trumpers and let them know about it. Is that right?
And let them know about
okay.
it. Okay. Yeah, because I mean, think about it. And this is one of the reasons attribution in 2016 is not just the FBI. Microsoft is sort of like a mini NSA. I mean, they've got visibility over the entire world. So if anybody's using their infrastructure to do something like this, Microsoft is actually going to be able to figure some of it out, which is what happened. Mm. They either approach Trump directly or approach, and that's how you get to Roger Stone. It mm-hmm. sounds like they identified Roger Stone as compromised and they addressed Roger Stone. Roger Stone is claiming he's cooperating. He is, of course, a pathological liar. So I am now curious how and in what way he is not cooperating, because if he says he's cooperating, then chances are he's not. The okay. thing that I have a concern, about, even generally, Donald Trump has not firewalled his campaign from his crimes. And by that, I mean, he was investigated for defrauding his supporters by raising money, claiming to spend it on voter integrity, and instead spending it on the defense lawyers for his people.
Right.
That's the most important example, but there are, you know, maybe 50 examples of the ways in which his campaign, like the money he's raising, is going into his defense funds.
Right.
And he is using that to pay off loyal staffers, and he is imposing loyalty tests on them before he gives them that money. And then other loyal staffers are using it to get rich. It's just this cesspool. And the problem with it being a cesspool, I mean, and the vetting document the New York Times described the J.D. Vance vetting document as having been done by a law firm called Brand Woodward.
Mm-hmm.
And Stanley Woodward represents 8 Donald Trump flunkies. So Stan Woodward, who, by the way, in court documents, it has made it quite clear that he's not all that adept with cybersecurity himself.
Mm-hmm.
Stan Woodward is this person whose firm was part of vetting J.D. Vance, but who also knows exactly, has been read into the 32 documents, the 32 classified documents charged against Donald Trump. He's the defense attorney for Walt Nauta.
Mm-hmm.
So because you've got a document in, we assume, the Iranians' hands, that really hits to the core of that overlap, of the overlap. I mean, why would you put they're not the best people to hire for vetting. There are other Republican firms you can do that. Whatever reason, Donald Trump decided to hire these ultra loyal people who are key to his defense, who are not the best people to vet J.D. Vance. So that's one of the reasons I want to find out whether they did a good job of vetting J.D. Vance. And so if you, for example, were to hack their computer,
yeah,
it'd be a gold mine. It'd be a gold mine, and it'd be a gold mine that would make all of us less secure. Because remember, we know one of the documents charged against Donald Trump is a document that summarizes the 2019 plans against Iran if they attacked us.
Right.
There's another one that almost certainly describes Iran's, what we knew in the same time period about Iran's nuclear program. There are probably another 2 that pertain to leaving the Iran deal that Obama formed. There are documents that Trump stole that pertain to Iran. So if you are hacking people in the vicinity of Stan Woodward,
yeah,
if you have a document that was private and confidential that involves Stan Woodward, then you're getting a lot closer to things that go to Trump's stolen documents case. And that's one of several reasons. It's not the only one, but that's one of several reasons where if the Iranians were as successful as Russia was, you could have like a snowballing effect,
yeah,
on the national security implications here. The other thing that's really important. Oh, go ahead.
Well, no, I just sort of want to review this because Brand Woodward, this legal company that did the vetting of J.D. Vance, Stan Woodward, and I should note Stan Brand, who has been a guest on this show a couple of times over the years. But if you were able to get the documents coming from their office, it is likely that their office also has these other documents, these national security documents related to Trump's national security case.
Would be related. They would not be the actual documents,
okay,
that Trump is charged with,
because
those are in a vault somewhere.
Discussion
so
about those documents, perhaps,
yeah,
between the
right
attorneys?
I mean, that, right, exactly. I mean, there is stuff that is confidential that pertains to these that might help Iran figure out what was charged. This is the point, is that, most normal human beings firewall these things. Most normal human beings have their defense attorneys and they pay their defense attorneys out of one fund.
Right.
They have their political fundraising and that's all one fund, which is how it's supposed to be legally. And then they have their private business. And Donald Trump has never kept those separate. We know he hasn't kept them separate. And so if, for example, the senior Trump advisor who was attempted to be hacked was somebody like Susie Wiles, who's one of his two campaign managers. Mm-hmm. She's in charge of spending all the money, but she's also in charge of deciding whether people are loyal enough to have their defense attorneys paid for. Mm-hmm. So they're like, it's not just the lawyers who overlap like this. Susie Wiles, who is a very likely possibility for being the person who was at least attempted to be hacked, is another one. And so those are the reasons why the fact that Donald Trump may have been hacked raise additional concerns. That's not the only one. One of the other ones, which is really important, is the FBI on July 12th, actually the day before Thomas Crooks tried to shoot Donald Trump in a field in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. the FBI arrested this guy in Houston, a guy by the name of Asif Merchant, mm-hmm. who is Pakistani, but he has ties to Iran. And they charged him with attempting to solicit people to assassinate Donald Trump as payback for the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that guy was doing, and we assume he may not be the only one, we assume that the informant that the FBI used to get to him is by no means the only one who is recruiting people to shoot Donald Trump. And in addition to recruiting assassins to shoot Donald Trump, and again, this guy is tied to the same people who hacked Roger Stone, as far as we know. He also was recruiting fake protesters, just right. like the Russians did in 2016.
Yeah.
And the fake protesters were going to serve as a distraction to create an assassination attempt. And so, again, if you get Donald Trump's internal strategy about when you're going to do big rallies, for example, and Iran gets that, and they're, you know, trying to solicit people to be fake protesters to set up an assassination. I mean, it's just Donald Trump is sloppy, and legitimately, I mean, the assassination attempt, there's no reason to doubt the FBI on this. They've charged this guy, and mm-hmm. we know, for example, that the Republican Guard also tried to assassinate John Bolton. I mean, this is real, right? Like, they're pissed that their guy got killed. And so you are, you know, no matter what people thought about Hillary Clinton, there wasn't this kind of assassination effort by a hostile. Russia wasn't trying to assassinate Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
They've assassinated other people. They weren't trying to assassinate Hillary Clinton. Iran genuinely is trying to assassinate Trump or people close to him. And that changes the import of the additional targeting of his campaign files. And, you know, I hate the guy, right? But this is real. This is real life. And unfortunately, this is where we're dealing with.
Yeah. I mean, all the stakes, the actual stakes, not the campaign stakes, not the political stakes, but the actual national security stakes and everything else just seem so much higher here. And yet you, going back to where we were discussing earlier, that you have sort of a completely different take on it all, it seems, at least as of now, by the media. I hope they understand the national security implications. You're describing, Marcy Wheeler, you've done it, I know, on Twitter and at emptywheel.net. And I got to go. But it, just very quickly, if Iran was able to do this and if they were able potentially to get, you know, access to that material, I presume it's also feasible that Russia might have access to that same material, either on their own or in cahoots with Iranian hackers, China, and so forth, right?
Russia is in cahoots with Iran, and Russia was in cahoots with Roger Stone. So it's not the other thing that makes the Roger Stone targeting really interesting is in 2020, the same people, or the Republican Guard, had a campaign in which they pretended to be Proud Boys and contacted registered Democrats and said, you have to vote for Donald Trump. We know how you're going to vote. It was a intimidation campaign. And that, of course, is interesting because Roger Stone is also super close to the Proud Boys. So the targeting of Roger Stone may not be separate from what Iran already tried to do in 2020 when they were pretending to be Roger Stone's buddies and intimidating Democrats that way.
As always, I recommend people keep their eyes on Marcy Wheeler, whether it is at the site still known as Twitter, at Empty Wheel, or at her own blog, of course, with all the details, emptywheel.net, where she is an independent national security journalist paying attention to the stuff that matters, whether the rest of the media figures it out or not, or whether they follow her lead and eventually figure it out. Marcy, always great speaking with you.
So good to be on. Thanks.
Thank you, Marcy. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.